Well, Peter Hurkos, the one we're talking about as well, manifested his extrasensory perception, he claims, following a head injury that resulted from a fall from a ladder when he was 30. He died in Los Angeles at the ripe age of 77 years old. It was June of 1988. I'll be back in a moment. Stacey Horn is our guest tonight. We'll take phone calls next hour with her on Coast to Coast AM. What did J.B. Ryan think of Peter Hurkos, Stacey?
He didn't really like Peter Hurkos. He thought that he was irresponsible. I mean, just the way he led this family on is a perfect example. If he had abilities, he exaggerated them and in a way that was harmful to the people who were depending on him for help. In fact, I was thinking, you know, while I was talking, like, I loved going through these letters that they got. They got letters from people all over the country. Everyone would write them whenever something strange happened. And frequently, the underlying tone of these letters was sad. It was people who were basically saying, help me.
They were desperate, yeah.
Yeah. Something had happened that they couldn't explain. You know, they saw something or had abilities, and they were just reaching out to science, you know, help me. So he didn't think Peter Hurkos was the right answer, you know, to someone who...
Did he question his authenticity?
No. He tried to get Peter Hurkos in the lab to study his abilities, and Peter Hurkos, you know, kept saying, oh, yeah, sure, and somehow never showed up. And that was frequently the case. Now, part of me was actually sympathetic to that because these people would come into the lab, and maybe they do have the abilities, but they're not able to produce them on demand. So it could happen that they would show up in the lab, not do a thing, then J.B. Ryan in his lab would write that up, and it would be picked up by newspapers all over the world, basically saying, you know, this guy's, you know, a fraud. He couldn't produce in the lab, and that would be it for him. I mean, who wants to sign up for that?
Well, that's a good point. Good point indeed. Let's move on into some other areas too. The people that tried to get J.B. Ryan to experiment with other hallucinogens, peyote, for example, I guess ayahuasca as well.
Mm-hmm.
Did he try this himself?
Yeah, he finally did. He was always very resistant. I actually found a letter from 1936. The commissioner for the Bureau of Indian Affairs sent him peyote in the mail and said, yeah, here's this thing we were coming across. Try it. And so people wanted him to experiment with it to see, you know, again, they were always looking for ways to understand and enhance these abilities. So they were thinking, well, maybe these drugs would liberate them in some way. But J.B. Ryan was a very, very cautious investigator, so he resisted for a long time. And then in the 60s, he was invited to a panel at Harvard about ESP. And the other psychologists at Harvard who were invited to join him, like, everyone refused. Like most scientists, they were, like, reluctant to be associated with these questions. But one person, jumped on it, and that was Timothy Leary. So they met, they hit it off, the panel went really, really well, and Timothy Leary is, like J.B. Ryan, very charismatic personality. So Timothy Leary was able to convince him to give it a try. So a couple of months later, him and Richard Alpert got on a plane, went down to Duke, and a bunch of scientists in the lab took psilocybin. And I read their write-ups. Ryan was not terribly impressed. He said that the effect was pretty mild, and he didn't really see anything to suggest it would be helpful to them, and it was definitely a drug that was hard to control, so it wasn't going to help them with their issues of control and enhancement. But reading their letters to each other was just hysterical. They were both very, very different men. Like, Ryan was very conservative, look at this carefully in the lab, and Leary was like an anthropologist, and he wanted to, you know, work.
Let's run with it.
Yeah.
But did they respect each other?
Yes, they very much liked and respected each other.
Did you stumble across any letters to J.B. Ryan from my aunt?
No.
And they're going to say, who's my aunt, right?
Yes.
Dr. Shafika Karegula? Would you have seen any of those? Because during his time period, she was huge in ESP research on the West Coast. I mean, huge.
It would be easy enough to find out if there were letters. The archive down at the Special Collections Library at Duke is very well organized. And if you know roughly what year, it's all the letters are alphabetical. So I'm going down there, actually, in a week, and I'm going to go look up some things, and I can easily look. I'll write down her name and the year.
Okay. All right, great. Because she wrote the book called Breakthrough to Creativity. So just Google that, and then you'll get all the information you need.
Okay.
And I'm pretty sure she did. You know, if he was doing this and she was doing this, I'm sure the two met.
He tended to meet everyone and correspond with everybody that was working along these lines. Breakthrough to Creativity?
Yep.
Okay.
Let's get into the poltergeist end again, which has always fascinated me. Did JB come up with any conclusions about that?
No. That was the only case that they got any look at, but they concluded it was authentic, which was, you know, a big deal, and it was a case that they were able to study enough and in person that they could make that kind of conclusion. But like every other experiment and test and investigation, that's all they conclude, that we have evidence of this. We still don't know a lot about it.
Do you believe it?
Yeah. Yeah, I talked to my friends, like, I kind of cringe about when this book is going to come out, because I found what I found, and I could find no convincing reasons to discount these results and these conclusions that they made. And after having spent years reading the response that they got from scientists, I'm not looking forward to the response that I may get.
Are you branching out into other areas of investigating this entire phenomenon, or did you just hone in on J.B. Ryan and you're going to just stick with that?
I am open to the idea. I'm not entirely sure which direction I would go. There was one intriguing thing that I came across. They didn't study ghosts to a great degree, just because they couldn't get a ghost into a lab, and Ryan was all about the lab.
Yeah.
But one thing they did do was, because all these people were writing them all the time, they literally had thousands and thousands and thousands of letters from people describing experiences, and it was an amazing resource. So they quite rightly decided we should survey these letters and see what patterns emerge from these experiences. And one of the things they discovered was, if people are experiencing ghosts, they're hearing them more than seeing them, hearing voices, footsteps, things moving. And it's something that now, like, there's all this recent research that's saying people hear things, and not, it was always believed that if people heard things, they were mentally ill. But now there's recent research, and a lot of it, that has come out and said, no, apparently lots of people hear things who are perfectly normal, not mentally ill, and the things that they're hearing are not necessarily disturbing. And I just thought it was interesting that this information actually has already been out there, and it came about as a result of a survey of ghost stories.
How would you rate the contribution of Ryan into the field of parapsychology? Huge? Or not at all? Or minimal?
Well, as a result of the experiments and applying the scientific method to the research, I think he gave it a foothold. Like, it was all, mediums and ectoplasm, and there was, like, it was an amateur, and there was no really serious investigation to look, can we really establish this in a less ambiguous way? And he gave parapsychology a start in that direction. And so I think pretty much most of the parapsychologists working today are influenced by J.B. Ryan.
And he tried to do it through science.
Yes. Which, I mean, that's the main thing.
Yes.
Applying the scientific method to parapsychology.
And by trying to do it through science, had he, I think, continued it, he may have had some incredible breakthroughs.
Yeah, he always thought the answer was somehow in consciousness, which seems to be the big thing today. everywhere, not just in parapsychology, but in science. I mean, they admit we don't really know a lot about it, and it does seem to be more key than we originally thought.
Tell me a little bit about the ghost story in Harlem.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was, you know, my original idea was, I'm going to write about a ghost story. And that was the ghost story that I was had planned to write about. And it was just because I had heard about it when I was a kid. There's a mansion in Harlem, the Morris Jamel Mansion. It's very well known. George Washington used it as his headquarters for a while. And the story I'd heard when I was a kid was there were a bunch of school children outside the mansion waiting for a tour to begin, but they arrived early, and so they're waiting for someone to show up to let them in. And they were outside playing, and this woman came out on the balcony and told them to shut up. And, you know, you're being too loud. And then she went back in. She glided back in. And the curator arrived, and the kids said, we saw this woman on the balcony, but the building was closed. There was nobody inside, so it was, you know, said to be the ghost of Eliza Jamel, who had once been the mistress of the mansion. And the story was in all the papers, and Hans Holzer, who was a well-known ghost hunter at the time, had a seance, and all this information came out about Eliza Jamel, that she had murdered her husband in order to marry Aaron Burr.
Okay.
And yeah. What?
No, go ahead.
Anyway, so that was the story, and so I was going to research that, and I actually started. And one of the things I wanted to do was see if I could track down one of those kids from that day. And I thought, you know, there was a chance, you know, a lot of people, you know, don't move away from the places that they grew up. So there was a chance I'd find one. And I did. And I was absolutely convinced that if I had ever tracked someone down, one of these kids down, that they would just say, we made it up. So I tracked one of the kids down, and that was not what she said. And what she said was very interesting, because she said, we never said we saw a ghost. You know, she was not transparent. There was nothing ghost-like about her. She was absolutely, completely solid, but she was dressed, you know, funny. But we didn't think anything of that either, because, you know, we were showing up for this, you know, Revolutionary War.
Sure, they were all that way, right?
Yeah, so it was completely expected. And it wasn't until the curator, you know, showed that the building was locked, nobody was inside. In fact, the balcony where she had appeared was padlocked. So that was interesting.
You write a little bit about Jackie Gleason trying to convince Ryan, right?
Yeah.
To join him in a TV show? Tell me about that.
Yeah, that's
was cool.
Fun. That was fun. Jackie Gleason apparently was totally into this.
Oh, he was huge. Yeah, he was huge into UFOs, extraterrestrials. He was a friend of Richard Nixon's. And, you know, there's a story, by the way, on the Jackie Gleason end that Nixon brought Jackie Gleason down to Homestead Air Force Base and showed him dead aliens that they had down there in jars. And apparently he was never the same. His wife at the time, Gleason's wife at the time, mentioned that. But what was this
story? Does that seem like a credible story?
Yeah, it does. I mean, and it's all over the UFO circles. And it was, it apparently had stemmed from Gleason's wife at the time.
That's... When did that happen?
Oh, gosh. When was Nixon president? It was...
70?
No, 68, 60. Right?
60. Well, he resigned in 74, right?
Yeah, 68. Yeah. He got elected in 68 and resigned in 74, so it was in that time period somewhere.
Well, the reason I ask is because Nixon and Ryan had a correspondence, and parapsychology actually never came up, and it was fascinating. I mean, it's not parapsychology related, but they started writing each other because Ryan had written a letter to the editor of Life magazine because a picture of the Little Rock Nine, the black children trying to get into school, and
it was on the cover.
Right,
yep.
And they were escorted by the National Guard,
yep.
And this ugly picture of, you know, being taunted. And Ryan had written a letter to the editor of Life magazine about the children, and how they were basically the bravest people in America right now. And Nixon read the letter and was moved by this and wrote Ryan, and so they struck up a correspondence. And why it was interesting to me, because I grew up in the 70s, so I have this picture of Nixon. And what Nixon wrote about with Ryan was protest and rebellion, but he wrote about it in positive terms, like the importance of protest and rebellion and integrity and standing up for your beliefs. And
Nixon?
Yes.
Hey, boy, you never practiced it.
He was talking. Well, he was actually talking about protest in other countries. So maybe he felt our country was just fine and there was nothing to protest. And he was talking about the value of it in other repressive regimes.
Yeah, all right.
Which is ironic.
That I could understand that.
But still, it was clear from his letters, like, I guess he's a very complicated man because he was very educated, compassionate, and thoughtful in these letters.
Well, he also had a great foreign policy.
Yeah.
But, you know.
But the reason why I bring this up is parapsychology never came up, and so you would think if he had an interest or any kind of open mind in this area, he's writing J.B. Ryan, you would think it would come out then.
All right, but back to Gleason.
Okay. Yeah, Gleason, I was not aware when I went down there of Gleason's interest. And so he wanted to do a television program about parapsychology, and so he wrote Ryan trying to interest in him in doing it with him. And he would say, like, he knew what Ryan was like, so he said, this is going to be a very serious thing, you know, it's not going to be a woo-woo thing. And Ryan was, like, you know, open, and they went back and forth, but at some point you just stopped hearing from Gleason, and Gleason went on and did the Honeymooners.
See, I don't think Hollywood was interested in Gleason taking a serious approach. I think they looked at him as a comedian, and that's what they wanted.
Oh, that's a good point.
You know, unfortunately. Of everything that J.B. Ryan did at his parapsychology lab, is there one thing that stands out as the best thing he ever accomplished?
Well, accomplishing coming up with these experiments to establish telepathy, which I believe he did. I mean, I researched this to the best of my ability. I looked at all the points that the critics made, and I could find no convincing reason to reject this work.
So you can conclude beyond a shadow of a doubt that telepathy exists based on J.B. Ryan's experiments.
I can't say. What I was able to discover that it's telepathy. All I can say is this effect is real. I don't know that the hypothesis that it's telepathy is the explanation. The way I put it at the end of my book, because I had to put it some way, and I felt weird because I'm not a scientist, but what I said was, there seems to be another source of information in the world. I think that might be because I have a background in telecommunications. I kind of look at the problem this way. There's information out there. We don't know. You know, we can't explain anything about how it's transmitted and processed, but there's just too much evidence that people have some way of accessing it that we do not understand.
Was this lab funded by the university or outside sources?
It was not funded by the university. I mean, they provided
the space.
Yeah, space, and they gave Ryan a secretary and salaries, but the money for the experiments, you know, was all over the place, and it was just so interesting to me who funded it, like Alfred P. Sloan. Do you know who he is? He was the former president of General Motors.
Was he the Sloan Kettering Institute?
Exactly, yeah. With Kettering. He started the Sloan Kettering Institute. He funded the lab out of his own pocket. Chester Carlson, the founder of the Xerox process, gave them a lot of money. The Navy, the Rockefeller Foundation. Oh, and that was another thing I found out. The guy that decided to give them a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation was a guy named Dr. Alan Gregg, and he's the same guy that funded Kinsey at roughly the same time.
All right, stay with us, Stacy. We're going to take some fast blast questions for you next on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take your fast blast questions this half hour with Stacy Horn, then your phone calls next hour. Jerry Purnell, the science and science fiction writer and writes many great sci-fi books with Larry Niven, just sent me an email. He said, George, I lived right next to Peter Hurkos during his day. And I would talk to him quite often, sometimes short, sometimes a little longer. And he said, I never was able to quite believe whether or not he was real or not, but he was sure consistent in everything he said. He would even go on crime scenes, and some of the detectives would really never quite understand what he was doing fishing around, but they said some of his work was pretty helpful. So that's interesting. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Stacy, in 1963, the Air Force published a report of an ESP machine that they had built named Veritac. Tell me about that one.
Yeah, Ryan always had wanted to build a machine just to automate at least part of the experiment, so charges of fraud could be eliminated.
Yeah.
He actually even contacted IBM way back when. I think the first letter I came across was in the 30s, and they were into it. But the first machine was actually built by, the Air Force of all people.
Did it work?
Well, they did experiments for a year and did not come up with evidence of ESP. But the guys that were doing it, they didn't think they were done. This was just the first, attempt, and they had planned to continue, but the Army said no, no more.
Michael writes from Winchester, Virginia, quoting Stephen Wright, if any of you believe in telekinesis, raise my hand.
Well, yeah.
How many people at the, and I call it the Ryan Institute, you call it the Duke Parapsychology Laboratory, but how many people went through there as psychics or as mediums to be tested?
The only one that they really tested was a medium named Eileen Garrett, but I want to get back to that comment about raise my hand, because they they did all these experiments with psychokinesis, and they found people had the ability, but only a tiny little bit. The experiment that they ultimately went with was rolling dice, because again, like the cards, it was very unambiguous. You know, either you got the roll you were aiming for or not. And they found that people could, but again, nobody's going to go to Las Vegas and win a pile of money based on these skills. They're only very slight. But to me, I don't understand why that would be a reason to dismiss them. I mean, because it's just we can only do it a little bit, so, like, who cares? And besides, you know, if we do learn more about it, we might be able to figure out a way to enhance
it. Well, he had to, Stacy, weigh probability. You know, if you flip a coin 10 times, the probability says five heads, five tails, right? Or 100 times or whatever, 50-50.
Right.
He had to go beyond that. And if somebody was able to predict, let's say, the coin flip 60% of the time, 60-40, to me, that shows some kind of clairvoyance or telepathy.
Exactly. It's all about probability and statistics, and they were able to demonstrate that people could do it more than what would be expected by chance.
Mary from Canton, Ohio. Did J.B. Ryan ever have an opinion about Edgar Cayce, the great American prophet?
I tried to find out. There wasn't a lot about it. What I was able to find out was he went and met with him once, and it could be that they met more than once, but I couldn't find it. And he was like, Cayce billed for what he was doing, and Ryan didn't like that. I mean, in science, it's all very pure, and yes, you get funding, but you don't charge the public for it. But Cayce was, also needed to make a living. So, I don't know. It was a problem for Ryan. So I think it biased him against Cayce.
Beth from Omaha, were you scared at all of any of the stories that you were reading, the letters?
No, to me it was more sad than scary, but a couple of times, like when I was researching EVP, these are the people that record voices, I thought, oh, I'll try that. And then I thought, no, I won't try that, because the last thing I want to know is that there are people talking in my apartment.
Explain that a little more.
Well, let's say I, put the recorder on. One of the EVP voices that I heard that just haunted me, this guy Dave recorded a voice in the cemetery saying, "Help me, David." Now, if I recorded a voice in my apartment saying, "Help me, Stacy," that would torture me. Like, I would want to help the person, but, you know, what help could I possibly give them now?
Any other place like Duke University in the United States today?
Oh, I'm glad that got asked again, because I forgot to mention there is something at the University of Virginia called the Division of Perceptual Studies.
Arin, tell me about that.
Well, I don't know a lot about them, but they research life after death, ghosts, poltergeist, reincarnation, and I have looked into a little bit, and it's very fascinating, the stuff that they're working on there.
We've had a number of great guests over the years, Stacy, who do a lot of this on their own. They're not affiliated specifically with a university or not. You know, one or two of them, I think, would like to be. They've been trying to get programs instituted. But it would be great to have a degree in this, wouldn't it?
Yeah. And there were places that had offered it for a while. And Duke, people actually got PhDs for a time in parapsychology. But none that I'm aware of now.
So I'm looking at all these stories that made the book. What didn't make it?
Well, there's one of the things I loved doing was looking at cases of seances and then trying to verify the information. Just because at the time when these seances were conducted, there just weren't a lot of ways to verify them, but now we can. And I found this one story of a haunting a few blocks from me in the West Village of Manhattan. And it was just really intriguing because it was close by. And the person that was living in the house at the time was this Manhattan Project scientist. Who was reporting it. So that made it even more interesting. And the case was written up at the time, and once again, Hans Holzer came with his medium, and they came up with all these names and information from the seance. And one of the things that had happened was they were hearing the footsteps of a woman throughout the house while they were doing these renovations. And one day, a workman was working on the ceiling, and this tin fell out from the ceiling on his head, and it turned out to be this tin of ashes of this woman named Elizabeth Bullock, and it was dated, I believe, 1931. So Holzer comes out with all this information from the seance. So I've been working now to seeing and verifying whether any of the information is correct.
Kyle writes from New Mexico. He says, look, I've written about this before to you. Just because someone can predict a coin flip 60% of the time does not mean they have powers. The law of large numbers says that they will indeed predict only 50% if they predict coin flips long enough. Well, that's true, unless they have a gift. Is there a number that J.B. Ryan talked about that would be unusual, that would be psychic? Maybe it's not 60%. I don't know.
Well, I want to get back to that because I addressed that, and probability and statistics is a very tricky subject, but, I mean, it's true that improbable things happen. They just don't happen a lot. So if you can establish that someone can do this again and again and again and again, there is something going on. I'm not sure what he's saying.
Well, he's saying that 60% of the time does not mean you're psychic.
Well, how would you explain it?
The law of numbers.
The law of numbers says that you would get it 50%.
Well, I know, but I think he's saying eventually it'll come down to that.
No. Again,
you may start off at 60, maybe 70, but eventually you'll wind your way down to 50%.
Right, but that's not what happened. That's what I said. Improbable things do happen, but can you repeat it?
Time and time again.
Yes.
I mean,
He's absolutely right. Yes, if it was just a one-off thing or a few times, that would be something else.
Did JB investigate remote viewing specifically?
It wasn't called remote viewing at the time, but yes. I mean, they started out thinking telepathy involved a sender and a receiver. But what they found, especially when they were studying the letters, that people got information regardless of whether or not there was a sender involved. So, again, they didn't they didn't call it remote viewing, but they started to get the idea that people could get information in other ways without a sender, that they could go out and get images of the world in different ways. And to me, that's closer to remote viewing.
What did they ascertain about life after death? Did they come up with any specific conclusions?
No, they could never answer that question.
Never.
There was no convincing evidence of life after death. I just think their experiments opened the door to the possibility of life after death, but they could not answer that question.
What about reincarnation?
They did not look at that question.
What about scientists who looked at what they were doing? Did they have problems with scientists?
Oh, lots of problems with scientists. But, you know, the interesting thing was scientists would be publicly hostile and also privately hostile, but a lot of scientists were friendlier in the letters than they would be publicly. They were more intrigued. They just didn't want to admit that. A perfect example was H.L. Mencken. Do you know H.L. Mencken?
Tell me the story.
He's a journalist, and he would often write very, very critical but funny, scathing commentaries. And he wrote one about, I don't know if it was just Rhine or parapsychology, but it just was withering about the kind of work they were doing. And then I came across a letter from H.L. Mencken to J.B. Rhine. It's like, well, you know, I have my doubts. But he said, I'm intrigued, and then ends with giving him suggestions for experiments. And that was typical.
Yeah, it would have been better, though, had he gotten some support publicly, huh?
I agree.
Did the university want to just, I mean, did it come to a point ever where they felt, let's get rid of this division here, this department?
A number of them did. A number of them did. They were embarrassed by it, but not all. They would get support. Like, I think the guy that was the president just after they left, Terry Sanford, who became a politician, was he the governor or senator down in North Carolina? But he was supportive.
What has become of the Rhine family?
They are still around. Sally Rhine Feather is the director of the Rhine Research Center, which still exists.
And what do they do? Same thing?
Less experiments, and that's probably because there's less money these days.
Right.
So it's more focused on education, and like a lot of people in science, they are also more focused on studying questions of consciousness.
Would they endorse what you wrote in Unbelievable?
Oh, I believe so. They helped me all the way through. I couldn't have done it without the Rhine family and also the family of Gaither Pratt. That was Rhine's like most senior scientist.
And when they disbanded publicly, were they upset?
When who disbanded?
Well, you know, you got the little thing, but I mean, based on the university relationship, when they disbanded that.
There were problems, like it's like any breakup, but they were friendly again, and they have a very good relationship with Duke now, and even with the problems, I think they were always very friendly, and anybody at Duke, any of the professors and people at other labs that, you know, were interested in these questions, you know, kept contact with Rhine.
Where are the letters now? They have them? The letters?
Yeah, the letters are at the Special Collections Library at Duke. 700 boxes of them.
700 boxes? Type, handwritten, everything.
Yeah.
And how far back do they go?
The 20s.
That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. It's a wonderful, wonderful archive. I love going through it. It's just this incredible, you know, picture of America and the kind of strange things that happen to people here.
You know, the work that they did was astronomical, I think. I've always been a believer in this, and I'm glad that they did what they did at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were just paving the way, mm-hmm. Stacy.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, that guy that made that comment about Hercos, I wanted to say again that...
That guy, Jerry Purnell? He's one of the world's greatest sci-fi writers and science writers.
I'm sorry.
That guy.
I'm sorry. My apologies. But Ryan was open to the possibility that Herkos had genuine abilities. His only problem was his irresponsible behavior, not his abilities.
And now, what do you mean by his irresponsible behavior? The fact, again, like...
Well, with the family, with the missing boy.
But you know what? He didn't want to tell them the kid was dead. He made them feel good, didn't he? For a while.
No, what he did was...
Because they went with
him. The kids in Oregon, thank you for your money, and I'm leaving. And they said, wait a minute. He said, the police can help you now. And they're like, wait a minute, you know, Oregon...
Well, he did that later, didn't he?
No, he
from the get-go?
That. Yes. And then he said, I'll help you more. And then he wouldn't return their phone calls. And he just drew it out unnecessarily.
4 years ago, I recall, I think it was 4 years ago, I had J.B. Ryan's oldest daughter, Aunt Sally, on the program. And she talked about the work of the father. She was always interested in what he did.
Mm-hmm.
Always.
Well, she was very close with her father. He's a very charismatic man. I listened to tape recordings of him, and his voice is kind of like Frank Langella. It's very elegant, languid, and slow, and I was captivated just listening to him.
Is there anybody like him anymore doing this?
The closest would be Robert John at Princeton, even though they...
With the Egg Project and things, the Princeton Eggs, you've heard of those, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So they're still actively researching.
But that's it? What about other countries, Stacey?
Well, I was more focused on Ryan, so I'm not like the expert on everything that's going on now. Like, if it intersected with Ryan and came out of his work, I know about it. If it doesn't, I know less about it. There are people whose work I would like to know more about, and one of them would be Rupert Sheldrake, who...
Oh, yeah, he's great.
Yes, I was...
He's great.
...so impressed with him. I saw him on a couple of things, and he's just so articulate and smart.
You know, he was at a conference some time ago. Somebody leaped from there, chased him up to the stage where he was, stabbed him in the leg.
Oh, I heard about that. Yeah. Oh my God, I did hear about that. How is he?
He's okay, but you got to be careful. I mean, the guy could have lunged and got him in the heart, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
I mean, dangerous times.
That was another thing. Like in the letters, Ryan would frequently get letters from people who were clearly
hate letters.
Not hate letters. Just people who were mentally ill. It, again, sad.
Mm-hmm. Well, but he seemed like he tried to help everybody.
Oh, he answered everyone practically. Sometimes somebody else would answer for them, but these incredibly sad letters, like this woman who was convinced that her son was buried alive, and he just, people like this, he would answer all of them with tremendous compassion.
Buried alive reminds me of The Vanishing. Ugh.
Oh, I know. God, don't remind me of that movie.
What a movie that was, huh? Hey, what's your website?
www.stacyhorn.com.
Stacy, right?
Yes.
Horn.
Yes.
.com. All right, we're going to take phone calls with you when we come back, Stacy. You ready?
Yes.
Okay, phone calls. Your next stories, if you want to share some of your incredible stories of parapsychology with us, too, that is fine. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.